start out and give me a brief bio of yourself.
Well, I was born in Washington, D.C. I grew up in the bedroom community of the CIA and the NSA, the Pentagon, and some agencies that in those days nobody even knew the initials of, like the DIA and the NRO, the spy community. And what I came to learn fairly early was a second government that operated behind and more powerfully than the visible and supposedly legitimate democratic government that we expect to have. And my parents were Pentagon employees, civilian employees of the Pentagon for many years, as was my aunt. I spent time in the building as a child. I was left off in the library quite often, which was somewhat revealing to me, because I like to read. And I really began to have my deeper suspicions about the country at the time of first the McCarthy era, which I didn't really fully understand. I was born in 47, and this was mid-50s, but I knew my parents were afraid of McCarthy, and I knew they were relieved when he was finally stood down by Stuart Symington and Joseph Welch and the people that stood up to his tyranny. And also, I think the first really revelatory event for me in a political sense was the U-2, which was a spy plane that was downed in the Soviet Union. And the U.S. was forced to admit it was spying on the Soviet Union. And that was quite a revelation. We had not only been denying that, but we had been playing a game of Cold War espionage after the end of World War II that we claimed the Russians were doing, but we were above all that. And so it really openly showed that the government would lie, not only to the other people abroad, but to the citizens, and that they would do covert operations and secret things. The next major thing that hit me when I was still in grade school was in the early 60s when the Cuban Missile Crisis came. And even though we were kids and didn't understand a lot, most of us knew that we were on the brink of potential end-of-the-world disaster. And we never knew how close it got. I found out years later by talking to one of the pilots for the Strategic Air Command that was in the air that day, but they came within 30 seconds of a fail-safe order, which is a no-callback order for nuclear war. And it came right to the brink, but everybody was holding their breath. I had earlier refused to get under my desk when I was about 10 in a nuclear bomb drill because I couldn't see, even at 10 years old, how a desk could protect me from what they were explaining to me this bomb did. And I began to realize that the adults in whom I had to place my trust were a little bit insane, not only because they were telling me to get under a desk for a huge bomb blast, but also because they were willing to use such bombs or had such bombs and would do things with them, made them into dangerous people, in my mind. And then the Vietnam War was really formative, as well as the Kennedy assassination in my consciousness. So I was a political activist from 64 on against the war. I worked later with Vietnam Veterans Against the War. I did draft GI and veteran counseling. And I began doing research about 67 into the Kennedy assassination in earnest after reading one of the critics' books and read the entire Warren Commission volumes and focused on the critical books on the case and did a lot of independent research and came to believe after 30 years of research that what happened November 22nd in Dallas was actually a military coup d'etat. And in the late 90s, I formed the Coalition on Political Assassinations with the research community that works on JFK, and we were instrumental in getting the bill passed in 92 to release the Kennedy files. And it wasn't actually implemented till 94, and then we were an oversight watchdog group for that process, and it's been the largest release of classified documents in history, over 6 million pages. And it's very revelatory. It's changed the history of the Bay of Pigs and our understanding of it, of the Cuban Missile Crisis itself. There's a new movie out called 13 Days, based in large part on the new documents that show that Kennedy was surrounded by people ready to go to a nuclear war with the Soviet Union, and he was the voice of reason in the room that balked at it, not the one that was playing the brinksmanship, and that the Joint Chiefs, especially Curtis LeMay, were trying to undermine him. And I believe the Joint Chiefs, for that and several other reasons, that the Kennedys were balking at the war in Vietnam, wanting to end the Cold War, and making other enemies for a variety of reasons, that those enemies were sort of gathered together and congealed into effectively a coup that was orchestrated out of the Pentagon, out of the Joint Chiefs Office, and that we've been basically in the death grip of that military-industrial complex. Since then, they still call the shots. There are occasional attempts by other elements in the country, other money, to rise above that and run the country in a different way, but they're usually thwarted either by scandal or by assassination. And right now we're in what I believe is the end of an argument that was reportedly started in August, or at least reported on in August, between the Joint Chiefs and the Bush administration about whether we should go to a Pax Americana and admit that we're an empire and become one all around the world. And I believe that that's the model that's being implemented right now by Rumsfeld and these others in the Pentagon and the White House. So I was just witness to those events. I like to read and do research. I became sort of an alternate historian. You know, they have a term now for anybody that says anything is a conspiracy, that we're theorists. And I've always said that you can call me a conspiracy theorist if you call everyone else a coincidence theorist. But I think we ought to aggressively start a new term, that people are conspiracy deniers, in the same way that people are Holocaust deniers, because the reality is that there are conspiracies in the world. There's not one monolithic conspiracy, but there are conspiracies, which merely means that there are people in secret who plan criminal activity and carry it out, especially in terms of political assassinations. That has been the case, although we've been handed a story that these are always lone nuts acting on their own. These people are what Oswald described himself as, patsies, who are set up to take the blame, but in fact didn't commit the crime. I have been a grassroots activist. I still raise money for progressive projects here in D.C., and more recently I've been working with a group out of New York that's a communication resource for progressive organizations called Avenging Angels.
And I also understand you do work with militarization in the schools.
Yes, I'm part of an organization here called Choices, and it's mostly veterans, and we go into the high schools on career days because there's a rule in D.C. that if military recruiters come into the schools on those days, of course they're in there all year round with junior ROTC and other things, but on career days at least we can come in. There's a rule that says that they have to let the other side come in. So we present realities of military life to young people before they enlist, and we let them know that there are civilian options where they can get similar or better training on up-to-date equipment for career advancement in the civilian world, where they can get civilian funds for college, and that many of the promises the military makes actually don't bear out for people, especially the people here who are African-American right now coming out of the military. African-American males are twice as unemployed and four times as homeless as the kids from the same community that don't go in, mostly because of the bad discharge system and that they don't learn usable skills in the military. And they're four times as likely, if they're African-American, to end up with a court-martial and twice as likely to end up with a less than honorable discharge when they get out of the military as the white troops. And so we feel that black youth especially, and youth of color, and women are putting themselves at risk. Very high levels of rape and sexual harassment in the military. Even though it's a hostile reporting system, there's a report of 10 times the level of rape in the military as is reported in the civilian sector. And women are generally not allowed to advance in the ranks and given the dead-end jobs, as are people of color. So we advise that people at least look when they're making this choice, because the one job that comes to them aggressively is the military. And it's a huge military. But I was just reading an article last night quoting General White, one of the recruiting command people in the Army, who said something without understanding the implications of what he said. He talked about how they had to take in over 175,000 a year in new recruits, and then said, there's no other corporation in the world that has a recruiting task like this. Well, that's right. But there's also no other corporation in the world that is losing the people that are coming in at the same rate that the military loses them. And if there was such a corporation, it either would have gone broke long ago, or somebody would have stepped in from personnel finance to say that with the cost of training and equipping and carrying these people and then losing them at this rate that we have to constantly have a new flow of recruits, something's wrong in the way that we're handling the people that we're getting in. We don't keep them. 75% don't finish their first term of enlistment. And so they have a huge recruiting job, first because they have a bloated military with way too many people in it. It's over 200,000 people stationed in bases around the world. And one of the ironic things after September 11th is the military is complaining that defending the United States is a burden because they're too taxed overseas.
So the military itself, who do you feel would be the primary people in charge of that? Would that be the Joint Chiefs of Staff? Would
the Joint Chiefs of Staff primarily and Secretary of Defense. To varying degrees, the White House either is in charge of it or is not, depending on whether their people get in.
But when they're complaining about being stretched too thin overseas, whose decision would that have been for them to be there? Would that have been theirs?
Well, ostensibly, these are, you know, the military will say, we have nothing to do with these decisions. This is what Congress tells us to do, or the president, and we just follow our orders. But in fact, they last, in their structure of the military and the military-industrial complex that Eisenhower warned about, lasts longer as an institution than any of the presidents or Congress people do, for the most part. A few Congress people have been around since the end of World War II. But basically, they created at the end of World War II a permanent war economy and a bloated military budget. I mean, I wanted to get a bumper sticker that said, the deficit, it's the Pentagon, stupid. Because that's where the money drain is. And when you talk about cutting taxes and increasing Pentagon costs and budget, which Bush is doing, an already totally insane $329 billion budget. He wants to add $40 billion more onto it. I mean, you can take the nine largest countries, next largest, you know, militaries down the way, and they don't come to the cost of our military. It's a huge military machine, and it's wasteful. But they spend all this money on it, and it takes it then eventually out of the social services and out of the economy. Money in the military does not create jobs for the most part. Not per dollar, bang for buck. Civilian investment pays off in jobs a lot better because the military is not labor-intensive. It's development-intensive, weapon-intensive. And the weapons are sort of the ultimate product. You can only use them once, and then you have to replace them. And then there's constant pressure to upgrade to new generations of weapons. And then, in addition, we're paying for past wars and retirements, pensions, VA funds, as well as present and future wars. It's certainly possible with a cut of at least 30%, if not closer to 50%, to defend the United States with that military force. But that's not what we're about. We intervene constantly in the business and government of other countries, covertly and then overtly when we decide to. And in order to have that kind of a force that's all over the world, that's an imperial force, we have gutted the industrial base and economy. I think the Nazis were very brilliant at the end of the war. I think that by coming in here, bringing the intelligence information here, and pitting us against the Soviet Union, they took their two former enemies and put them at battle with each other. Both those countries militarized in a huge arms race and ruined their domestic economies because of it and their industrial bases because of it. Meanwhile, Japan and Germany, the former Axis partners, demilitarized and built up their industrial base and became capitalist competitors. The only thing they were lacking and still lack, and that's part of what the U.S. is in these wars in the Gulf and elsewhere, and in Afghanistan right now, about is access to oil for Europe or the competing countries, that the U.S. wants to control that.
Well, that kind of brings us up to our current situation with the U.S. military bombing Afghanistan and very aggressively working at bringing bases and treaties and such with different countries in the oil-rich Caspian Sea region.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about that a bit.
Well, I think there's two broad contexts, and the oil is a piece, of the broader one, which has to do with the plans of the Cold War and the eventual demise of the Soviet Union. And the architects of that demise included William Casey at the CIA, and also Zbigniew Brzezinski at an early point in the Carter administration, even before the Reagan years. He now admits that Carter and he signed off on the beginnings of covert operations in Afghanistan and the training and arming of a anti-Soviet military there. There have been some comparisons made between September 11 and Pearl Harbor, and I found that particularly interesting because I don't think they're a direct comparison, but I do think there are parallels, but they're parallels in the real history of Pearl Harbor and not the official history. The first theme is that this was a complete surprise attack. I just heard Condoleezza Rice yesterday on Fox News radio show saying that, this was completely outside the box. There was no way anybody could have expected this coming. Well, that's patently ridiculous. I mean, first of all, the alleged perpetrator, Osama bin Laden, had been on the top of the radar screen for years, especially since the 1993 bombing of the Trade Tower itself. So to make a comparison to Pearl Harbor, it would be as if the Japanese had attacked a U.S. site 7 years before, I guess, and then come back and attack the same site again, and we would say that this was a complete surprise. So the location and the attacker were already identified and under scrutiny, but somehow couldn't be seen. The question of the type of attack was not even a surprise to them. There were even special precautions made earlier in the year, in the summer, when Bush went abroad, to make sure that there were no aerial attacks. I believe it was when he was in Genoa in Italy, so the planes couldn't attack him. And there was a constant consciousness in the Reagan administration about airplanes. If you remember, an airplane went into the side of the White House, and special preparations were made at the White House to defend against that since, but weren't used on September the 11th. And there were instances, in fact, where elements of the al-Qaeda group and the Afghani Mujahideen in the war with Chechnya had, both in Chechnya and the Soviet Union, crashed commercial planes into buildings. And there was an incident in Paris so in the 90s. So this was not an unknown method of attack either. So the idea that this was just so completely outside the box that nobody could see it coming is a little disingenuous. So it wasn't a surprise attack, but the most significant thing about the real history of Pearl Harbor is that they knew Pearl Harbor was coming. And apparently, for political reasons and wanting to get into the war, let it come. And I think that's the actual parallel to September 11, and I can talk about why. But to back up a bit, Brzezinski, in one of his books early on, says that to finally defeat the Soviet Union, surround it militarily, and crush it, that the U.S. will have to establish a military presence in one country, and he names the country. Do you know which one it was?
No.
Uzbekistan. And that's the country that we've now shifted to. I think we shifted in the Gulf War from Israel to Saudi in order to get closer to the control of the oil in that region. And now we're shifting out of Saudi into Uzbekistan to essentially surround the Soviet Union in the Caspian Sea. Also, there were additional moves, but Casey and these people were planning to knock out a Soviet government, Soviet-backed government in Afghanistan back in the 90s, and they began to fund these very reactionary mullahs and mujahideen troops who came in from all over the world, and they were part of reactionary Islamic anti-Soviet elements around the world. Now, there were probably legitimate ethnic grievances to some extent, but it's a little bit too much to me to see Bush taking credit for freeing the women of Afghanistan when women were being educated and had open jobs in the society and were not being openly discriminated against in the years when the Soviet Union, you know, Afghanistan was part of the Soviet Union. When the Soviet governments were in there, they were progressive and they didn't discriminate against women. And in fact, it was a reactionary coup by these mullahs coming in that the Soviets were fighting. And when they came in, they changed the status of women. So, I mean, we may say we're liberating the women now, but we helped to put them under that rule in the first place. And we had no trouble with the cultural aspects of the reactionaries that we were backing in Afghanistan and paying to do this dirty work for us against the Soviet military. And they saw the Soviets as slipping into what would be their Vietnam and hoping it would drain them and destabilize them, which it did. And this was a conscious plan that they carried out there in Afghanistan. And so the United States trained and funded, built the underground cave complexes that we're talking about now, bombing. This was all part of U.S. funding and support through Defense Intelligence and the CIA. The NSA helped out with communication and information. And the military was supporting what was happening in the Soviet Union and the gathering of these Islamic troops. And they provided them weapons that they wouldn't otherwise have had, because Afghanistan is one of the poorest of the Arab nations. They have some natural gas in the country, but they basically have a very minimalized economy. After the overthrow of the Soviet Union, another delightful development is that they became what was known as the Golden Crescent, the center of 80% of the production of world opium traffic. Heroin and, coming from opium, but 80% was coming out of that country and being processed either there and surrounding areas with the help of other reactionary forces like the KLA in Bosnia and the Kosovo Liberation Army, and that were also drug financed. And this really is the model of choice since about the 1970s, at least, of the CIA. And actually the history of CIA involvement in drug traffic goes back further than that. It goes back to the end of World War II. But the idea of using the drugs as the way to finance the covert operations and keep them off the books was one that appealed to the CIA and other people. And so they had a hand in cultivating the elements that were growing opium as their mercenaries and secondaries, like the Mao tribes in Vietnam. That was the situation there when the center of world opium growing had been the Golden Triangle of Burma, Laos, and Vietnam. And similarly throughout South America and the cocaine, there's an interrelation between the drug trafficking and the development of reactionary forces and proto-fascist forces that supported by the CIA for covert operations and overthrows and assassinations, and that's how it's financed. I've often said that the reason the CIA won't let its budget be released is because it wouldn't cover its operations, and they'd have to explain the difference. But that happened there, and it's happening again now. In fact, last year, at one point before all this broke out, the U.S. had paid the Taliban $43 million to stop opium production, and the Taliban had put a halt to it in the farms, and then the Northern Alliance people took over. The people that are now being called moderate leaders in Afghanistan, and the people coming out of the Northern Alliance into leadership, are actually the top people that were either working with the oil companies or with the drug trade that had been named several years before in the international press. So these two things are, part of the economy there. But the U.S. didn't care about the oppression of women when they were funding these mullahs against the Soviet Union. Their whole point was they were going to get somebody that was anti-Soviet. They don't care, obviously, in that Cold War about the niceties. I mean, they'll support somebody like a fascist like Pinochet in Chile against a legitimate socialist elected person like Allende. As long as they're anti-communist, they're good enough for them. And that really is the crux of the Cold War and how we made the original alliances with the Nazis at the end of World War II as enemies of the Soviet Union. Whoever's the enemy of our enemy is our friend, logic, and we brought hundreds of these Nazi spies and scientists and operators here into the United States, and they formed, according to Bobby Inman of the CIA after he retired, he admitted to me in a public forum, that network that came in under General Reinhard Gehlen, Hitler's top spy officer into the United States, were the foundations of the Cold War here. And so we don't mind aligning ourselves with these fascistic elements, and of course there are fascistic elements in the United States as well. But this idea of trying to gut the Soviet Union by funding and arming these people went on not only through the fall of the Soviet Union, but afterwards. And this idea that the problem is that we walked away from Afghanistan is just not the case. There was constant and steady funding using the Pakistani intelligence services, or ISI, as the conduit. The CIA continued to fund the development of the Taliban and the Al-Qaeda. And Osama bin Laden was used by Pakistani intelligence, by U.S. intelligence, and by Saudi rulers and their intelligence and government money in a variety of ways. I mean, he's from a very rich Saudi family. And even though they claim the family's completely broken off their ties, when he was sick in the hospital in Dubai, the French reporters saw family names on the roster were coming to visit him while he was there. And he had ongoing ties with Pakistani intelligence, especially the chief, who, among other things, had to step down in October because of his funding of bin Laden, but also because he had directly provided $100,000 to Mohammed Atta, this pilot that was allegedly involved in the September 11 attack. And so this head of the Pakistani intelligence stepped down because of his ties to funding bin Laden, and he had been the main conduit of CIA funds to bin Laden. And in fact, he had been here in the United States on September the 4th, meeting with the CIA, meeting with Richard Armitage, part of the old Iran-Contra network, in the days prior to September 11th, and then wasn't even able to get a flight back till well after the event on September the 11th to get back to his country, and then eventually was demoted. But much of the rest of the apparatus that he ran was not demoted and was still in place to be of assistance to these people. So the idea that we had no ongoing relationship to these people, I think, is false. Osama bin Laden and his people operated in Kosovo on our behalf. They operated in Chechnya on our behalf. They operated in Paris on someone's behalf. So even if we can link the people involved in the September 11 incident back to the Al-Qaeda, and even if that's demonstrably the case, and we have still very little evidence, hard evidence of what, and they've refused to show us the evidence of what they have about all this, but even if it does go back to him, that doesn't tell us who the ultimate sponsor of September the 11th is. But this was an ongoing covert relationship that served our purposes, both with the Taliban and the Al-Qaeda, up until September the 11th, and I would argue to some extent even afterwards. So it's not something coming entirely out of the blue. It's a development that comes from covert operations and things that we began. Another parallel of interest to me in the Pearl Harbor incident is that the United States boycotted the oil going into Japan prior to the attack. Now, does that say it justifies the attack on Pearl Harbor? It justifies the bombing of innocent civilians in New York? No, that's not the point. It's that it has a historical context. In other words, when the United States carried out this boycott, which was equivalent to an act of war, it gave rise to elements within the militarist class in Japan who had been pushing for an attack on the United States. A rather suicidal concept, but that's where they were, and so in the same way that if you goad the United States, it will respond and the militarist elements will take a hand. And so one thing can lead to another. The oil around the Caspian Sea in what remains of the former Soviet Union countries is a huge deposit of oil. There's another one that was discovered in the southern peninsula of Saudi Arabia at the time of the Gulf War, right across the sea from Ethiopia, Somalia, those areas. Those are strategic deposits of oil. And it's not so much that the United States has to have that oil for its use. It's how that oil is going to be distributed and whether or not it's going to get loose, in a sense, through pipelines to the European market at a cheap rate. And this is what the United States, I believe, is fighting to avoid in all situations, so that the oil instead will be put on tankers controlled by the U.S. corporations. And when the tankers get out to sea, then they are bid by the ports, and the highest bidding port gets the oil, which artificially inflates the price of the oil and keeps it high and keeps the competitors in line. A lot of the development of the Trilateral Commission, which is Japan, Germany, and the United States, a sort of new axis of world leadership, came from David Rockefeller and the U.S. oil companies forcing Japan and Germany into a new axis, a new post-World War axis with the United States. And I think it qualifies a great deal more as the axis of evil than these small countries that George Bush is naming as the enemies. But that grouping, their ability to force Japan and Germany into a sort of hegemony in world planning and globalization, really comes out of the fact that the U.S. has the reins in terms of controlling the oil. And Kuwait was central as a wedge, that the British knew that too, and created Kuwait out of the old Iraqi country. It had been a province of Iraq and the old Ottoman Empire, but they artificially created Kuwait in order to block oil getting down to the sea. Another interesting fact that I dug up was that of the oil that's used by the United States, and the United States uses the vast amount of oil, and it's tremendously oil-dependent in its economy and how it runs its energy, and doesn't have to be. There are alternative energy routes, but they don't take them because the oil wants to maintain the monopoly and the profits from it. We're about 4% of the world population now, and we're using up over 60% of the world's oil. Within that pie that we use, in 1985, 65%, and it was projected that by 2000 it would be closer to 80 to 85% of the oil use is military use. What that means to me is that the military is fighting wars to preserve oil so that it has enough oil to fight the wars. And I heard Schwarzkopf in an interview at Texas A&M University say that the amount of oil necessary to run the Gulf War, they had a 10-year anniversary meeting, you know, with all the hoopla, the great Gulf War and our victory. The amount of oil necessary to run that war was 3.5 billion gallons of oil. Well, that's more oil than was contested between Iraq and Kuwait by far, and probably a very large percentage of the oil even available in Kuwait. So it's not so much that we need the oil as that we need it to run the military, and we need the military there to make sure that we control it from other countries getting a hold of it. But the Caspian Sea deposit is critical, as is all the resources and cheap educated labor within the Soviet Union. And when the USSR fell, there was a huge rush of the globalist corporations to compromise it and the surrounding countries and get them into the neoliberal model so that the profits could be made there. And that's part of what's going on, is really a strangulation of the remaining blocks of resistance. And there are things that were happening in earlier in the year that are very telling in terms of September 11th. I thought it was very telling that on the day after September the 11th, China, for instance, on the 12th, jumped into the World Trade Organization. And I think that September the 11th actually shifted world politics into two camps. And this is what Bush is talking about in his simplistic way when he says you're either for us or against us. The one camp is all of the currently compromised neoliberal industrial countries that are under the control of the corporations. And then there's the wannabes, like China and the Soviet Union. And they're all lined up on one side. And what's left, then, is the underdeveloped countries and the pockets of resistance within the neoliberal countries. And they become the terrorists now. And so any sort of resistance to the corporate model is going to be assigned that way and then attacked. But if we back up a little bit, probably the country that financed and harbored terrorism around the world more than any other is the United States itself. And until we take a look at that and the covert operations that we carried on, the terror that we created, you know, not only in Vietnam but in Chile and in many, many other countries, Nicaragua, we had terror campaigns against the population. We funded the Contras, who were a terrorist group, directly because we wanted to make political changes, and we had covert operations and assassinations that terrorized people. So, I mean, we brought terror to a great deal of the world. And I was just going over last night articles in my email base in the period prior to September 11th, just there at the beginning of September, and there's so many important things going on. One thing that's being reported on is that Belarus, Byelorussia, and the area around Minsk and the old White Russian strongholds, that the U.S. was carrying on a terror campaign there that was being compared actively to what we had done in Nicaragua, and that they were funding groups there. And then, of course, there were like the KLA and other groups that we financed and supported against the governments in Serbia and in Kosovo and that whole conflict. So the U.S. operates in this way. It funds groups, arms groups, trains groups, gives them the equipment that they need in order to carry out terror campaigns. And the fashionable idea now in much of the left publications that talk about this at all is that this is blowback, which is a term that, relating to intelligence operations that have an unintended consequence. So we created this Frankenstein and it suddenly attacked us. I don't think that's exactly what's going on. I mean, I think that it's more likely that there were elements within the intelligence agencies that right up to and including September the 11th knew what was happening in that circle and let it come. If they weren't encouraging it, they at least let it come. You know, I don't think that the situation is out of control. I mean, we went from saying that Osama bin Laden was the worst person on earth and we have to get him to saying, oh, well, we're smoking him out of his cave to, you know, well, you know, he's only one among many, and don't worry, we'll get him, but we're working on other things, to, well, we don't really know if we'll ever get him, and that's not our mission, to, we don't know if he's dead or alive, we don't know where he is, and, you know, we've got bigger problems to handle. You know, I really wonder whether he'll ever be. He's more used to them as a will-o'-the-wisp who can go from country to country, and then they say, well, he's got a new base, that country has to be attacked. I think more importantly, we have to understand that stuff was happening prior to all this. For instance, in July, because of this issue of the Caspian Sea, and what that has to do with also is pipelines and corporations, Unocal was a big one in the United States, but also other groups, European groups that wanted to build pipelines, Russian pipelines that were proposed. So there were these conflicting pipelines. The question was, in part, would one going down through Afghanistan be allowed by the Taliban, and it seemed that the Taliban were balking, whether because they didn't want it or they wanted more money or whatever. And this new book that's now been translated from the French into the English, Osama bin Laden, The Forbidden Truth, talks about an FBI agent named O'Neill who died in the Twin Tower. He was head of security for the Twin Tower. He had quit the FBI over his disagreements with what was happening in terms of the terror operations. And he's quoted in the book as saying that the oil companies were blocking the U.S. investigations into al-Qaeda and bin Laden in the period prior to September 11. And then in addition, the book says that one of the companies came to the Taliban and said, you know, you can have either a carpet of gold or a carpet of bombs. And the current guy that's been, Karzai, who's been promoted into leadership is a guy that worked closely with the Unocal Corporation, which was one of these pipeline distributors. So there was a contention about whether they would let the pipeline through. And then in July, it was reported in Times of India, in July of last year, Colin Powell visited India, Pakistan, Uzbekistan, and several of the surrounding countries, and told the leaders in those countries that the United States was going to militarily intervene in Afghanistan in mid-October. This is July. So September 11 is not so much cause as it's pretext. And in fact, the parallel to Pearl Harbor may be that the announcement of the U.S. involvement there triggered in part the response, that it's the other way around, that what the U.S. did and was doing, was planning to do, triggered September the 11th, because we were going in there anyway. And I don't think that's been looked at. Again, I don't say these things to justify what happened, but you have to put things within a context. So we're carrying on terror campaigns in Belarus. This is like reported on the 6th of September. On the 8th of September, it's reported that the DIA, Defense Intelligence Agency, is going to work on a rarefied strain and developing a new strain of anthrax, supposedly to match some Russian strain. There were other articles on the 4th and 5th of September in the New York Times and the London Sunday Times about Operation Clear Vision, which was joint CIA and military operation with anthrax. And Rumsfeld revealed in that article saying that he asked the scientists at Fort Detrick to develop a new strain of anthrax through genetic engineering that would resist the antibiotics and would be a super weapon. Well, we now know from the scientific evaluation of these anthrax in the envelopes and things that didn't go to Bush or the people who were running the war, but went instead to their Democratic critics, Daschle and Leahy and the others. These powdered envelopes were a completely new and more lethal strain of anthrax that was developed with more, it had sort of more fluffiness, as they call it, more ability to spread. And obviously doesn't show the mark of Iraq, because the processing that they use for weapons grade leaves an aluminum trace, and there was none in it, and it doesn't match the Soviet. And then they traced the batch back, and what kind it was genetically, to the Ames strain, which is specifically a U.S. strain. And now the main suspect for where it came from seems to be Fort Detrick. And so the FBI is saying that they're focusing their investigation on the CIA in terms of this anthrax stuff, and on the military as the base, as the source.
And meanwhile, that drops off the media radar screen.
Well, yeah, because that's not very talkable, is it? I mean, but those are the last... Those are the last things that were happening in the, you know, in the public discussion about the anthrax. It got back to the source, and then they walk away from it because the source is too hot. Another interesting thing is that it was reported just prior to, I think it was September 9th or 10th, just prior to the attack, the FBI apparently had a discussion with people at Ames, and Ames Labs in Iowa, at the University of Iowa, had maintained an archive of the various strains of anthrax that had been developed or discovered over 70 years, since the 1930s. This huge archive that made it possible, when anthrax appeared, to see if there had been genetic mutations, to see how it differed or was similar to other things that were going on, or possibly to trace its source. And the FBI basically gave Ames the impression that they had a green light to destroy this archive that had existed for 70 years, and so it was destroyed, which meant effectively that there was no way to actually trace the specific batch that this stuff came from, so it could be traced down to source.
Now, how does that correlate then with the fact that the FBI seems to be the agency that was tracing things back to the CIA? What you're saying there sounds like they're the bad guys, but as far as the investigation...
Well, I think you've got mixes of good and bad guys in all these agencies.
Okay.
I don't think, you know... But it's a pretty strange development. I mean, you know, that you're going to wipe out one of your basic research tools in the days just prior to all of this happening. This was in October. You know, it was just before the big stories broke. So, I don't know what's going on, but when the FBI blames the CIA, it tells me that there's some kind of a split in the people that are running the country. Scandals, generally, do not develop out of investigative reporting and honest press. The press is corporate controlled, and scandals are hushed up all the time. Scandals that are reported and become big news are generally, I believe, one end of or segment of the class and the ruling elements spilling the beans on another segment. And I think, in part, that the Enron scandal may be a retaliation of sorts against Bush and these people by elements who were hurt on September the 11th. Those Twin Towers housed, I don't know if you looked at the companies, but they housed basically the banking and investment corporations of the whole Eastern establishment. You know, that's what went down and who got hurt. And it may be that they decided to take a crack back at Bush through this Enron thing, because this scandal is going to grow. I mean, it's not going to get smaller. And it actually interrelates with elements of the September 11 matter. One of the major players that keeps popping up in the research is Carlyle Group, and this is a huge multi-billion-dollar investment firm that started here in D.C., and Bush Sr. is on their payroll and travels for them, and Bush Jr. invests through them, current president, and also, up until just recently, they were a major investment firm for the Bin Laden family out of Saudi Arabia. Bin Laden family took government-paid, CIA-paid construction contracts for a lot of the bases in Saudi, and also even for the operations in Afghanistan early on. Now, for image purposes, they said the Bin Ladens were bought out of the company. But it was a very visible link, and among other things, there's a tie between Carlyle Group and the ownership of Bioport, which is the main company making the anthrax vaccine that's going to get a huge government contract to do that. Carlisle is also very much invested in oil defense through United Defense Industries and communications operations and oil up in that region. So they're a sort of a funding link between Saudi and the bin Laden family and the Bushes. And they crop up at various points in terms of, you know, companies that they own or have control over being parts of these scenarios. But what I'm saying is that we had plans to go into Afghanistan prior to September 11 and to oust the Taliban and put in a group that was going to go along with whatever the corporate or money agenda was.
And the documentation on that keeps coming out more and more as time goes by.
Also, the largest military maneuvers in the world were described as happening on the September the 6th, and that was just a few days before, and that was the United States carrying on military operations in Egypt. And one of the people in the Armed Services Committee, Ike Skelton, was quoted as saying that he felt that the emphasis, and this is, again, just in the days prior, the emphasis of the military was now going to shift away from Europe and into Southeast Asia and that area, and that was going to be the hot spot. So it wasn't something that they didn't know was going to happen or that they weren't moving toward already. The most interesting thing to me about the event of September 11, because I was here in D.C., a friend called to wake me up when the first plane hit the tower, because they work in airport authority stuff here locally around Dulles. They know that this was a commercial airliner in an area where it should never have been, and that it didn't look good even on the first hit. And as I was talking to him, the second plane hit, and then he said, you know, well, the balloon is up. There was accident theory and coincidence theory went out the window at 9:05, and anybody with any sense knew that this was a concentrated attack and not some planes off course. By 8:25, NORAD knew that four planes had been hijacked. This is unprecedented. And when a plane, when a large commercial plane like that goes off course seriously, it's reported in the news almost immediately, much less when there's a hijacking going on. But there was not a word of these planes being off course nor hijacked until well after the buildings were hit. I saw Katie Couric, as I went down, turned on the television to watch the news reports of what was happening. And Katie Couric was looking at a background picture of a smoking tower, saying she thought maybe a bomb had gone off in the tower, that they didn't know what had happened. Then they started to get calls in, a guy coming up the Holland Tunnel that had seen an airplane wheel roll down the tunnel past him. There were witnesses on the street who saw the plane crash into the building. So just about the time that they're figuring out that this is a plane going into the building, then they're shocked watching the second one hit. But at first, nobody even knew a plane was off course. I've read articles since that the building itself had some defenses and that it's a no-fly zone, that there's supposed to be defenses there in New York and the surrounding area, including stuff on the building itself, presumed surface-to-air missiles, to stop a plane from running into them, because it had been a problem even if something went off course. You might say, well, nobody, you know, in a hijacking, normally what you do is you let the plane go where it's going to go, and then you negotiate to save the lives, and so you're not going to interfere with it. But by 9:05, that argument's gone, and there's two more planes up. And the most telling is the plane, flight number 77, which goes out of Dulles to LAX, which turned around in Ohio and started to head back for D.C. Now, they had enough notice by 9:05 to get alerted. They had about 35 minutes at least, closer to 40 minutes possibly, between the time they knew this plane turned around and knew that it was heading to D.C. to do something, to at least try to intercept it, if not shoot it down. The news said that by within moments after the second plane hit, Cheney and Bush spoke to each other and agreed that there would be a shoot-down order issued on the remaining planes, which meant that the military then had authority for shoot-down. If it didn't already, it had an official.
What news covered that?
I believe I picked that up in either New York Times or Post. It was online, one of the online reports. I know from growing up here in D.C. that commercial flights that go off course and come into this area, this is the most restricted airspace in the country, get intercepted, that helicopters or other kinds of planes fly up and shoo them out. And that's not some kind of a national emergency. That's just somebody off course. And pilots constantly complain here that they have to make these dangerous turns and come up the Potomac in order to land and take off here so as not to go into that restricted airspace. They knew, because I turned on Channel 8 in the local news, they knew that the plane was headed to D.C. They announced that the plane was headed to D.C. They began to evacuate buildings, including the Pentagon, prior to the hit. So everybody knew it was coming, is what I'm saying. And nothing, N-O-T-H-I-N-G, nothing, was done to stop it. It came into the airspace. It flew loops around the White House and the Capitol. Now, at least since the plane went in during the Clinton period, I say at least because there's also people standing around during the Reagan years with Stingers and surface-to-air missiles, things, you know, that launched launchers, but they put in an actual surface-to-air missile port on the front lawn of the White House and put some bushes around it to camouflage it a little bit after the plane went into the White House. And that plane should never have been able to come into that restricted airspace, and they made up a bunch of stories. They said, oh, they didn't see it on the radar. Then they said, oh, yeah, it's on the radar, but it came between 3 and 4 in the morning, and we don't look at the radar screen then. And I thought to myself, it's a good thing there's no real terrorists. They made up a bunch of excuses, but they could see it, and again, they let it happen. But this time, they had a surface-to-air missile there they could have used to protect the White House. It flew over the Capitol, and then it made this incredible, from 5,000 feet, 270-degree turn, this looping turn, and then came curling in and slammed into the side of the Pentagon. So it went out of its way, is what I'm telling you, because it doesn't have to make that turn to get to the Pentagon. The Pentagon has open space on all five sides. It's not that it had to go out of its way because something was in its way. It chose which side of the Pentagon it was going to, is what I'm telling you, and went out of its way to do it. And the side it went into was the empty side of the Pentagon, where they had been doing construction for almost 3 years. And anybody that had done any planning would have known that by just driving by and looking, seeing the construction stuff outside. And that's why the death level in D.C. was so low. You know, over 20,000 people work in the Pentagon. Any other side would have resulted in way more casualties. This killed more people outside in the plane and in the work crews than it killed in the building.
Is the construction on the Pentagon, is that well documented?
Yeah. I mean, anybody here knows it's been going on. Now, I was part of organizing an event back in the mid-90s called A Day Without the Pentagon. It was an event to highlight what one day of the Pentagon budget could pay for. And we did a march on the Pentagon itself from National Cemetery. Okay, and I had to have meetings because D.C. is unbelievable. There's like at least 16 different police forces here. It's a military district. It's a federal district. It's got local cops. It's got park police. It's got metro cops. It has National Monument. National Cemetery has its own police force. The Pentagon has its own police force. So I'm sitting in a room with one other person. We have about 16 different representatives, Arlington Street Police, sitting there negotiating this with us. Now, this is mid-90s, and they're telling us that we can't get up on the steps of the Pentagon and get real close because they're under a Delta threat alert. And they're under a Delta threat alert, they claim, because they're getting calls every day from Muslims who want to blow up the building, are saying that they planted bombs and bomb threats and all kinds of things. And they're asking us whether they're going to be Muslims in our march. And we said, yes, we work with, you know, Muslim groups, but they're peaceful. They're not going to blow up a bomb. That was already, I mean, by the mid-90s, they were that and that kind of an alert. And the guy taking me around, the head of their security, was pointing out to me that they had radar and camera coverage, both looking down around the building, but also looking up into the skies, and they had radar going. And I know from growing up in that building that in the center courtyard they have surface-to-air missile ports dating back into the 50s. And my father pointed them out to me when I was a kid. We'd go out there to eat lunch in the open courtyard, and they had missile ports then. And they weren't used. I mean, nothing was used to stop this plane. Nothing got in its way. They claimed they couldn't scramble the planes fast enough and that they took planes out of Langley Air Force Base, which is 130 miles away. Well, they have F-16s and F-18s right across the river at Andrews Air Force Base, at Anacostia Naval Air Station. And trust me, they're flying all around and bragging about it now, how they're defending it and complaining even how much they have to fly. But they didn't put anything up that day. And they didn't use any surface-to-air missiles. They didn't defend themselves against this plane. It obviously was being used as a weapon. There was, on the local news, an interview with people coming out of the White House being evacuated that saw the plane flying around overhead. And they were told that it was one of the president's doomsday planes by the Secret Service there. So I would say at the very least it was a stand-down. And I think that's why Bush is trying now to forestall any real congressional investigation of the events and what happened. But we've paid $13 trillion since the end of World War II for this massive defense and intelligence establishment. Has it protected us, or has it, through the covert operations and interventions abroad, garnered us enemies in such a way that we're reaping the harvest now? And do we really know what it does? How are we supposed to think of it? If it can't protect itself, its own building, how can it protect us?
All a lot of very good questions that are not getting answered in the media or by our representatives or anywhere else for that matter. Do you have some final words that you'd like to share with us prior to your arrival here in Seattle?
Well, I just think that we have to back up a bit and take a deep breath, understand that what happened on September 11th, as awful as it was, is not the end of the United States or Western civilization as we know it, and that the proper response to this, especially in the 21st century, is not a rule of force, but in fact a rule of law, that what happened September the 11th was a crime against humanity, and it should be dealt with as that. There are rules on the books to do that all over the world. It shouldn't be dealt with in secret military tribunals. It should be handled by an international tribunal, that the Bush administration has been very cleverly and insidiously meshing the idea of military retaliation and response with justice and criminal justice concepts, to the point that he is undermining posse comitatus and the separation of function of military and civilian law enforcement. And when that goes, democracy is really in trouble. That's what the Gestapo was a meshing of the military and the civilian police function. And we established that division as a bright line after our experiences in this country with British colonialism that also meshed that function. And the two should never be one. There's been tremendous militarization of the police, and that's a very bad trend as well. But Warner, Senator Warner, and others in the Bush administration are now openly calling to end the division between military and police function. And they're also creating a world in which they are the accusers, the prosecutors, the juries, the judges, and the executioners. And they're willing, apparently, to skip all the elements in between that have to do with evidence and just be the accusers and the executioners. They're pushing a posse mentality from the beginning, wanted dead or alive, we'll bring them to justice or bring justice to them. This is lynch mob mentality. And we have to get back to specifically the code of law and rule of law and international law that makes this kind of operation less possible. Because the only way that you can really address terrorism is not with more violence. That just increases the number of terrorists and its excuse. It is to undermine the authority and support and sanctuary of the terrorists by establishing justice. And in the 21st century, we have the technological capability to feed and clothe and house everyone on the planet, even to allow people to have good transportation and communication and some of the sort of gadgets that we like to play with. All of that's within our scope if we stop concentrating wealth into fewer and fewer hands and instead use it to meet human needs first. And we have the possibility of establishing a new world of global justice, and that's the crossroads that I believe we are at now. And we're either going to go down this nightmare path of an endless war that won't end in our lifetime, says Cheney, and of a recession and a worldwide global economic slump, or we can turn it around and we can make it into a real democracy here and abroad, not by force of guns, but by moral authority. And in the 21st century, war is a dead-end idea for the ecology, for the human community, for the kind of weapons that are being used and tested in these wars. It's just absolutely the wrong way to go, and it has consequences that never stop. The cycle of violence just replicates itself. Some of the bombings that happened in Paris, the terror bombings, were carried out by the sons of Algerian freedom fighters from 20 years before that were killed by the state. So once you establish the cycle of violence and the rule of force, it's never ending, and retaliation becomes the theme. We have to go another direction now. Martin Luther King said that the choice is not between violence and nonviolence, it's between nonviolence and nonexistence. And he was absolutely right.